Welcome to Physicians Weekly.
Welcome to part two of this Physicians Weekly special edition podcast, where we get to take a slightly deeper dive into actionable biomarkers in non-small cell lung cancer, or NSCLC. I am your host, Dr. Rachel Giles, from Medical Medical Publishers in collaboration with Physicians Weekly.
The Physicians Weekly podcast provides thought leader insights on the latest medical news, clinical trial coverage, and advances in medicine and healthcare.
Now, as I mentioned in the first part of this special edition podcast, the evolution of biomarkers informing therapy decisions really began in 2004, which started off when the FDA approved a medicine to treat EGFR-mutated non-small cell lung cancer. And since then, researchers have identified over 20 distinct mutations in driver genes that are specific to lung cancer, and 9 of which are treatable through FDA-approved therapy drugs. The molecular characterization of lung cancer has considerably changed the classification and treatment of these tumors, and has become an essential component of pathological diagnosis and oncologic therapy decisions. The success of targeted anti-cancer therapies and new immunotherapy approaches has created a new paradigm of personalized therapy, and it has also led to accelerated development of new drugs for lung cancer treatment. Additional research is needed to identify and help treat the approximately one-third of lung cancer patients for which biomarkers have not yet been identified. This podcast focuses on clinically relevant cancer biomarkers as targets for therapy, as well as potential new targets for drug development. And in the first part of the special edition podcast, which was published, I believe, about a week ago, we spoke with Professor David Waterhouse, who at that time had just moved to the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute at Harvard Medical School in Massachusetts, after having enjoyed a long career as the former director of the Clinical Research at Oncology Hematology Care in Cincinnati, Ohio. So check that one out. We talked about how these biomarkers are used in academic versus community hospitals. Now, in the second episode, I had the opportunity to speak with Associate Professor Sanchita Roy Chowdhury, and she's a molecular pathologist from the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston, Texas, who thinks that
all patients likely require biomarker testing.
We also talk about how best to implement actionable biomarkers for NSCLC, and when is it best to test for biomarkers, and how does that multidisciplinary tumor board work, and how pathologists have had to make sure they get all the tests they can get done and need to get done with sometimes very limited material. Anyway, enjoy listening. I think you'll learn something. Thank you very much, Dr. Roy. So could you tell me, how has the pathology lab changed as a result of all this molecular and, you know, histochemistry? Pathology is really driving the choice of treatments for many cancer types, but including and especially lung cancer. Could you describe a little bit how that has changed?
You're absolutely right. The field of pathology has evolved over time. We used to be primarily a diagnostic sort of modality. Pretty much all of the diagnoses were made in pathology. Immunohistochemistry has been around for many decades now, and it's kind of an ancillary tool that we use in pathology to help better classify our tumors. But more so recently, some of the immunohistochemistry tools that we're using kind of drive some of the decision making that we do downstream. And in the same light, some of the technology that we're using now, which are the more molecular-based technology, so DNA-based, RNA-based, have kind of evolved how we look at pathology. So it's kind of moved from being just something we use for diagnosing a tumor or some kind of a pathologic condition to something where we're actually looking at specific alterations in the patient's genomic profile and trying to predict the treatment that the patient should receive and how the patient's going to respond to treatment. So between immunohistochemistry and molecular testing, the ancillary studies part of pathology has gained a lot of importance, and it is helping our clinical team to take those decisions in terms of how to treat the patient and what kind of management each specific patient needs. So it's very tailored to individual patients, and that's kind of changed how we do patient care now.
Right. And is pathology represented in these clinical sort of multidisciplinary discussions? Could you describe who are the partners involved in these discussions?
So as with anything, it has to be a multidisciplinary approach. The patient comes to see their primary care physician or an oncologist if the need be, but then, you know, for the diagnosis, typically a tissue sample is taken, which could vary from, you know, interventional radiology to pulmonology, especially in cases where there's a suspicion of lung cancer, could be a thoracic surgeon. No matter how the tissue is collected, it always comes to a pathologist for the diagnostic part and then the ancillary studies part. So, and this is where the multidisciplinary approach is very important, because I think all of these physicians have to come together to ensure that the information is correctly communicated, the need for the ancillary studies, and the right adequate amount of tissue is collected so that all of the, you know, from the diagnosis to the ancillary studies, everything's done appropriately, because there's different ways of processing tissue, and we want to ensure that we're doing the best thing, the most optimal processing, to ensure that we can collect all of the information needed so that the patient gets the right treatment. So typically in any of these multidisciplinary meetings, like our tumor boards that we have, the pathologist definitely plays an important role confirming the diagnosis, also reporting the biomarker studies that have been performed so that we can come together with our clinical partners to formulate a treatment plan for how that patient should be treated.
Right. And now there's a lot of, you know, actionable biomarkers that are used in the treatment decisions for non-small cell lung cancer specifically. So are those all implemented in the pathology lab firstly, or is that done in a sequential or in a sort of a parallel manner?
So it probably varies somewhat depending on where you're practicing. So I'd say, you know, lung cancer, especially non-small cell lung cancer, has been at the forefront of this whole biomarker testing. And currently, if you look at the NCCN guidelines, there are 9 testing targets in non-small cell lung cancer that are approved for therapy. So that's standard of care for these patients. And then if you look at tumor agnostic markers, there's 2 more. There's MSI and tumor mutation burden. So you have a lot of targets that we are trying to identify in these patients that will ensure that these patients get a better treatment than just using chemotherapy, that patient outcomes are better. And so it's really critically important that we're able to test all of these different markers. Now, there are many different approaches to doing these biomarker studies. And most of the immunohistochemistry studies, of which PD-L1 is one of the most important ones, it's what drives the immunotherapy decisions in patients. That's something that is often done in the pathology lab because it's an immunohistochemical staining. Most labs are equipped to do that. Given the importance that it's a predictive marker, sometimes these are done in reference labs. So the pathology lab, if it's not set up to, if it's not validated, because that's a very important part of running a test, that your lab has to be validated for that assay. So if the pathology lab is not validated, they may choose to send it out to a reference lab, but the results come back to the lab. Often it's part of the pathology report as an addendum or a separate report. On the other hand, some of the molecular-based testing, not every lab is equipped to run it in-house. Like I said, you know, validation's really rigorous. There's a lot of key components to it. And some of the smaller labs may not necessarily have the infrastructure to do that in-house, and so may choose a reference lab because, again, the reference labs have these comprehensive panels that they're running. Individual labs don't have to worry about some of the issues with the validation, maintenance of the validation, and running these samples. But some of the larger academic centers would probably have an in-house testing. We at our institution do all of our testing in-house. It's done in a separate lab. It's part of the pathology lab, but it's its own molecular lab. It's a CLIA lab, so it has its own kind of inspection and validations done. So no matter where the testing's done, typically the test results do come back either directly to the clinician or to the pathologist to attend as part of the pathology report. So for example, at our institution, our pathologists handle the tissue. They're the ones who qualify the tissue for whether it's adequate for testing or not, send it to the molecular lab. It gets run. The biomarkers are reported as a separate molecular report, but both the pathologists as well as our oncologists have access to that report. And then in the multi-D tumor board, they will jointly look, you know, discuss the results and formulate the treatment plan.
All right, that's very clear. So you mentioned that there are 9 actionable biomarkers at the moment for NCLC. What's on the horizon? What's coming up?
So, you know, just to give you a perspective of, you know, how it's evolved and how quickly it's evolving, when I was in training about 10 years back, we had only a handful of genes that were approved in non-small cell lung cancer. And so it started off with EGFR being approved. Patients with EGFR mutations were sensitive to these tyrosine kinase inhibitors. And this was, I think, like around 2004. And then quickly, we had ALK and ROS1 that got approved. If you look at the first CAP guidelines that came out for molecular testing, it first came out for EGFR and ALK, and then the 2018 guidelines added ROS1. But they also, in the guidelines, said that there are several other biomarkers that look promising. And so if you are not doing individual testing, if you're doing a panel-based testing, these would be good to include in your panel. Because the NCCN guidelines, as opposed to the CAP guidelines, they're more nimble, so they quickly adapt to whatever new things are on the horizon that come up and look promising. And so when I talked about the 9 approved targets, I was talking about the NCCN guidelines because they quickly adapt to what the new studies show. And so right now, in addition to EGFR, ALK, and ROS1, we have RET fusions, MET exon 14 skipping mutations. We have BRAF and KRAS and NTRK. So, of course, there's always things going on behind the scene. There's a lot of things being looked into in terms of HER2 mutations and amplifications. Right now, KRAS G12C is what's approved, but looking at other KRAS mutations, those are things that people are looking into. And I wouldn't be surprised, because I think there was couple of years back where there were, like, every month the NCCN guidelines were being updated. And so for someone who does biomarker testing and who goes around giving a lot of presentations on, I was needing to update my slides every month because I couldn't do them fast enough. And so I wouldn't be surprised if quite quickly these guidelines change again and we're going to have new targets that get approved. And I think it's, you know, it's an exciting time to be working on non-small cell lung cancer because of the progress it's made in the last few years. And the best thing about targeted therapy is that these patients respond. Like, you know, if a patient has a targetable mutation and they're treated, they respond really quickly. And the outcomes are so much better than, you know, if you were to treat the patient with just chemotherapy.
Yeah, excellent. So are there any other comments that you would like to make about how we should be, you know, helping our patients get into this advanced precision medicine?
So the one thing we didn't really discuss is the need for kind of like these test results as quickly as possible. Because every time a patient comes in, most of the time, you know, they're either seeing their primary care physician. If there's a tumor, it gets picked up on some kind of imaging study. It isn't until maybe a couple of weeks later that they see the oncologist, sometimes even a month. And so oftentimes, these biomarker orders, the request for biomarker testing is placed by the oncologist. So I think having a heightened awareness for the need of biomarkers in these patients, so any patient, so currently, if you look at the guidelines, for metastatic tumors, irrespective of stage, so except for maybe stage 1A, all patients likely require biomarker testing. So having that awareness for the need for requesting the biomarker testing, because not every lab is set up to do reflex testing, because that's one other option, because some places have a way of doing reflex testing. So anytime a new diagnosis of non-small cell lung cancer is made, the pathologist can send a tissue for biomarker testing. So that's one way of doing it.
Right.
There are kind of regulations that are institution specific, state specific. A lot of it is tied to insurance and the billing and reimbursement. And so not every place can do that. And so in that case, requesting that biomarker testing as quickly as possible so that the right thing can be done is really critical. And then working with the molecular lab, you know, whether it's an in-house facility or a reference lab, knowing what they need, how much tissue is needed, what is considered adequate, so that the right testing can be done, you're collecting the right amount of specimen each time. And then there is also a push right now to do these more comprehensive panels, like a panel-based testing, given the need that, you know, we said there's 9 targets. You know, if you're going to be testing 9 targets one at a time, you're going to quickly run out of tissue, because most most of these specimens, they're metastatic tumors. It's like a small biopsy or a fine needle aspirate. They're limited volume specimens. So, you know, every time you run a different assay, you're going to need more tissue and you might run out of tissue. So if you could do one assay that looks at all of these targets, that's the best way to do this. But again, you know, that typically needs something like a next generation sequencing, which is relatively expensive. Not every lab has access to it. So depending on, you know, the infrastructure, the practice settings, it may or may not be feasible. So, but I think most of the professional society guidelines, if you look at them, they're kind of recommending doing panel-based testing, because if you look at studies, a large number of patients actually don't have enough tissue to do these, you know, get all of the test results for all of the biomarkers that are needed. And if you don't have all the needed information, oftentimes the physicians may choose, say, chemotherapy or something that's inferior to what the patient could have potentially be treated with and had a better outcome. So I think that's kind of critical, and kind of like working together as one team to ensure that we can get the right treatment to the patient every single time. I think that should be something that motivates us all the time.
That definitely is motivating for sure. So thank you so much for your time, Dr. Roy.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
That's all the time we have for today's podcast. Thank you so much for listening. Stay safe and stay healthy.
Physicians Weekly is produced in collaboration with Medicom Medical Publishers and Physicians Weekly.